Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and today my guest is Morgan Packme, and Morgan is the former editor of City and State magazine. And Morgan is a chess player, and Morgan is here to critique the movie Pawn Sacrifice, which is a movie about Bobby Fischer. Hi, Morgan. How are you?
Good morning, Cynthia. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. And you know what really struck me about the movie? Now, here's Fischer and Spassky, and they're competing for this chess match. And, you know, there's this, the Vietnam War is still going on. There's tensions between the Soviet Union and America, and it seems like they was like the embodiment of the whole geopolitical tensions. Would you agree with that assessment?
That's absolutely true. I mean, the Fischer-Spassky match riveted America, it riveted the Soviet Union. It was one of the it was completely symbolic, as you said, of the Cold War. And to have two people as the proxies in this titanic battle, and Spassky being representative of Russia's game, the degree to which chess is a part of life in Russia and the former Soviet Union cannot be exaggerated. When I was 14 years old, I went to Russia for a spell to study chess, and I was a national chess champion in the United States. But when I went over to Russia, I had a rude awakening that there were 36 young people my age who were not only as good as I was, but better than me. And so, you know, chess is life in so many ways in Russia. And so to have Boris Spassky being the representative of the Russian system versus an incredible, brilliant, eccentric weirdo like Bobby Fischer was just absolutely riveting.
Now, you know, they portrayed Bobby Fischer in the movie, as you said, to be a little eccentric. I took away from the movie that he was paranoid schizophrenic. Has there been any documentation of that?
Well, you know, for any of your listeners who are really interested in knowing the story of Bobby Fischer with depth and nuance, should read the book Endgame by my former boss, Frank Brady. He was the chairman of my department when I was a professor at St. John's University. And he had also written an earlier biography of Fischer called Profile of Prodigy. And that book had really captured the young Fischer. And then Endgame, which came out a few years ago, captured the totality of Fischer's life. And, you know, in terms of what kind of actual diagnosis his psychology has, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm hesitant to, you know, weigh in on that level. But what I can say is that he defies regular Hollywood narrative. And this is one of the problems with making a movie about him, because if you just look at it up until the World Championship, where Fischer ultimately prevails, I mean, that is ready-made for Hollywood. But it's the decades after that event when he descends into paranoid anti-Semitism, vehement anti-Americanism, you know, where he would literally greet people by saying, "Death to America," instead of "Hello." You know, that is where even his greatest fans just have a disconnect. And, you know, there are people who don't want to accept Fischer post his chess playing career. But to be fair, you have to really see him as a man. You have to take into account the totality of his lifetime.
Now, this match took place in 1972, and there were American troops still dying in Vietnam. And Bobby Fischer ultimately won that match. But then in later years, he went on to challenge Spassky again. What was the outcome of the second challenge?
Fischer, again, won the follow-up match with Spassky that happened many years later. And both of them were extremely diminished in their skills by that time. I mean, people, you know, your listeners who can just appreciate the fact that, you know, as a basketball player, if you don't play for 10, 15 years, your skills decrease. It's the same thing in chess. You introduced me as a chess player, but I'm actually a retired chess player. I stopped playing when I was 17 years old, and though I was a chess master at the time, my skills are exceedingly poor in comparison. It's like a language. If you don't speak the language, your language skills, leave you. And so when Fischer and Spassky played their follow-up match, it was more of nostalgia for the chess community and just wonder at the fact that Fischer had reemerged after so long. It was a very lucrative match for both of them. The purse was $5 million. And it was very amicable. Spassky was always a great defender of Fischer's and really showed tremendous respect for him. Fischer came, he won 10 games, he lost 5, and there were 15 draws, and, you know, he played okay, but nothing to be, you know, at the level that he once was.
Now, do the two men like each other?
It's hard to say, you know, that Fischer really liked anybody. He had very few friends, and he was a very abrasive, difficult personality, and he would fly into these fits of madness and paranoia, but they were certainly respectful of each other. Spassky was enormously respectful of Fischer and appreciative, I think, of the fact that he will be immortalized because of this matchup with Fischer. But he, Fischer, they're, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. There was a real element of that in 1972 with the fact that the Soviets would cheat. They would, do anything they could to try to unnerve Fischer. They were trying to, you know, use psychological warfare against him. But at the same time, his reaction was disproportionate to what was going on, and it was a reflection of his psychoses.
The movie portrayed that, like, you know, he exhibited these paranoid, actions, and, you know, the Soviets really kind of, like, instigated some of them. What makes chess unique?
Chess is an extraordinary game, and in fact, there's great argument whether it's a game or a sport or an art. It certainly encompasses elements of all three of those things. It is a profound mental battle. I was portrayed in a documentary when I was a child called Chess Kids by a wonderful director named Lynn Hamrick. And there's a person who observes in that documentary that when two children are sitting across the board from each other and they're playing a 3 or 4 hour game, that they will come to an understanding of each other at times that may be more profound than that relationship they have even with their close friends. I mean, you are looking so deep into a person's soul and you are observing the manifestations of their psychology on the board that it really is this extraordinary mental battle that takes place in chess. At the same time, it requires enormous patience. When I played in that world championship, student world championship that's portrayed in the movie Chess Kids, I played against the champion of Mexico, and over the course of 3 games, there were adjournments. It's where there's a stopping of the match and a resuming at a later time. But over 3 days, we played 26-hour game. And I was, 11 years old at the time. And that's extraordinary, physically grueling, mentally grueling undertaking. So, and in my daughter's school now, they teach chess. And it is because it hones this meditative, strategic, contemplative side of the intellect. And it is unique as a game in that respect.
I mean, can't you gain that same sense through reading and understanding what's going on in the world? I've never played chess, but can you get that profound intellectualism doing other things besides playing chess?
Oh, well, of course. I'm not saying that chess is the end-all or be-all, and, it's in part because I wanted to lead a fuller life and to explore, writing and being a filmmaker and all the things I've done in my career. And I felt that, playing chess was prohibitive to it because it requires so much time, so much dedication to be good at. But what is unique about chess is, as opposed to something like reading, there is no, you don't get your comeuppance when you make a mistake. It is truly a fight. You see when you make an error, you lose. You're punished. When you play some brilliant move and you succeed, you can triumph. And so there is an objectivity to chess. That the fact that there is an outcome that makes it different from other types of intellectual pursuits that you would from some sort of academic work.
Now, it was 1972, and like I said, the friction between the Soviet Union and America was still going on. What was the ramifications for both countries because of this chess match? Did it have an effect on politics that this chess, when the chess games were going on?
It was certainly a tremendous propaganda victory for the United States. It was thoroughly demoralizing for Russia, for the Soviet Union, to be defeated at their own game on the largest stage. Certainly, Fischer was elevated to iconic status. It had an enormous effect upon chess in the United States. Before Fischer, there was virtually no interest in chess, and then it spawned a whole generation of chess players who were riveted by Fischer's play. If Fischer had been a Michael Jordan type, if he had been a Tiger Woods type before Tiger Woods' ignominious fall, then he would have been able to crystallize it more. He certainly could have become, a superstar of extraordinary proportion. But shortly after the match, Fischer disappeared. And so there was that bounce from the world championship, but he never defended his title. He never had a chance to expand upon his legacy, and it was because he wasn't in a psychological state that would enable him to do so. He was, he was very crazy. And so that was, that I think blunted to a certain degree how much he had an impact on a global political scale. And ultimately, it's still just a chess game. And that symbolic victory, though, embraced by the United States, can only have such a great ripple effect. Maybe if there had been 2 years later another Fischer versus Russian matchup and Fischer again had won, perhaps that would have continued to have resonance. But the novelty of it I think was one of the things that made it so unique in its moment.
That was what struck me, the fact that it is a game, but at the same time it had such ramifications with the politics between the both countries. I found that totally fascinating.
You know, it's like the famous United States versus Soviet Union hockey match. We like to have we like to elevate people in terms of their importance and to find this battle of the minds and be representative of this Cold War, the struggle between the United States and Soviet Union was very appealing to the media, very appealing to world leaders, and there was this great underdog character about Fisher, which was also plays into the type of storytelling that we so love. You know, it's the little guy representing the United States against the big bad Russian, Iron Man, and that was certainly embodied in the 72 match.
Now, given the fact that today there is much friction between America and Putin's Russia, could something like this happen again, where there was an American and a Russian, competing for a world championship that could affect politics the way that match did?
I would say no. I mean, first of all, your listeners should know that the United States has never had another world champion since Fisher. And so we haven't really even had somebody who could legitimately vie for the title. We have some great young players now, there hasn't been somebody of Fisher's brilliance. It's impossible to overestimate or to exaggerate how extraordinary his performances were in the lead up to the World Championship. I mean, he wasn't just beating the competition, he was smashing the competition, shutting out the competition in many cases, and playing some of the greatest players in history up until that point. I think that the reason, though, that some sort of new Fisher-Spassky match wouldn't have as great significance is because the proliferation of media sources, that when you had just a Life magazine, that whoever was on the cover of Life magazine would be such a significant figure, and that there were just a few stations, and when there's a concentration of media attention, you can elevate something to a much grander scale. Now there's just too much noise for something to, I think, a chess match like that to emerge as such an embodiment of a proxy battle between the United States and Russia.
Have you totally given up chess?
Yes. I started playing chess when I was 2.5 years old, and I played serious tournament chess from I was 5 till I was 17 years old. It was an extraordinary opportunity for me in my life. As I said, I got to go study in Russia. I was fortunate to be portrayed in the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer as the best friend to the protagonist, Josh Waitzkin. Josh Waitzkin's father had written a book that I appeared in and was portrayed in this documentary, Chess Kids. And so it opened up a tremendous number of doors for me in my life and really exposed me to a cosmopolitan view of the world, a real sense of the extraordinary abilities that people possess. It enabled me to compete at the highest level of a sport, which is an extraordinary experience for anybody in any endeavor. When to be good at chess, it's just like if you want to be a good hitter in baseball, you have to swing the bat hours every day. You have to field the ball hours every day. When I was studying chess, I was studying 2 to 3 hours a day. When I was in Russia, I was studying 8 hours a day. That doesn't leave a lot of opportunity to do other things in your life. And I have greatest admiration for people who are professional chess players and reach the highest rungs of the game. But it had run its course for me.
One last question, Morgan. At 2.5,
yes.
Who are you playing with?
My father taught me. Started kind of reaching for the pieces. I showed some, I guess, modicum of aptitude. I don't know what that looks like when you're 2.5 years old, but I really took to it. And by the time I was 6 years old, I was the kindergarten national champion of the United States. And, you know, it was something that, and I was very fortunate to be surrounded by a great generation of young players, particularly from my school in New York City. You know, we won over a dozen and a half national championships as a team. So having so many great players around me also fueled my growth. And New York City at the time was really a mecca for chess players. And it was a very exciting thing to be a part of. And certainly for us, Fischer was always, he was a living legend. And all the mystery that enshrouded him only made him more desirable to want to study and to think about and to, and I hesitate to say emulate, but to just admire for his ability over the board.
Now, of course, you were born after the 72 match. Did you ever happen
yes.
to meet him? Yeah, I mean, oh, you did. So, tell us a little bit about that. That sounds exciting.
Well, I did not ever get to actually speak with him. I did attend one of the games in the 92 match. You know, I was very fortunate. Got to play informal games with Garry Kasparov, who was probably the most famous world champion after Fischer. And I got to play against Mikhail Tal, who was one of Fischer's greatest opponents. So I was in the same orbit, but, you know, I was born in 78, and, you know, Fischer was just disappeared for 20 years. And he reemerged in 1992, and then he kind of largely disappeared again. He was living abroad in Reykjavik in Iceland. Before that, he was in Japan. He was an inaccessible figure, and he didn't want to be accessed. You know, were it not for the millions of dollars that were at stake in the 92 match, I'm sure he wouldn't have come back then. And, you know, even at that moment, people thought that it was like a dream. They never thought that he would reemerge after being gone for so long. And the trope of the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, or at least of the book, as they kind of downplay it more in the movie, was about the search for Bobby Fischer. Would he reemerge? And that was like, you know, this apocryphal tale in its time. It's like, will anything ever come about? It always, there would be reports, Fischer would be doing this, Fischer would be doing that, but they were always spurious until out of the blue he finally reemerged.
In this country, in the United States, he reemerged in the United States?
No, he was being sought for income tax evasion by the United States. So he was very worried about returning. And by playing in the 92 match against Spassky, he violated international sanctions. I don't believe that he ever returned to the United States unless he did so clandestinely, and I don't think he had a desire to return. Yeah, I mean, he became one of America's fiercest critics.
Right. And that was brought out at the end of the movie. I suggest everybody see the movie Pawn Sex, but it was a great movie. And, you know, if you like...
And to read Frank Brady's book, Endgame... It's just as riveting, if not more so. And it's a very sad story of Fischer. I mean, it's an incredible one, but it's one that has no easy answers.
Morgan, thank you for taking the time to be on Focus on Albany. You've been listening to
Always
Morgan
a pleasure,
Cassidy.
Cynthia.
Thank you. If you like the show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, listen anytime, anywhere. Morgan, have a great day, and have a great day, everybody. Thank you.
You too. Take care.